Welcome to the MSP Law Podcast, where we share legal tips and strategies that help managed service providers and technology firms build a better defense. I'm your host, Tom Favinsky.
So touch a little bit on ESOPs. If you were ever thinking about converting to an ESOP, it's not a bad solution. It gets the bulk of your net worth in an ERISA-protected retirement plan with deferred tax growth. An ESOP-owned company can use its ESOP to finance acquisitions and do it with pre-tax dollars. Normally, when debt is incurred to finance an acquisition, only the interest that's being paid can be deducted on your taxes. But with ESOPs, they can actually deduct their principal payments too. If the acquisition is financed through an ESOP, you're getting that both of that treatment. This happens irrespective of whether you're a C corporation or an S corporation. C-Corp ESOPs have this really neat benefit where the owners, if they sell more than 30%, they can defer their equity, kind of like a 1031 exchange. They do a swap into publicly traded U.S.-owned company stock, like, let's say, GE preferred stock. As long as they do that within a one-year period of time, and it's more than 30% of their ownership, they can actually not recognize the sale to the ESOP of the 30%. They still get to be 70% owners too. So from their perspective, it's kind of cool. They take some money off the table. They put it into GE preferred stock. GE is a well-diversified company. They can access the money through a margin account if they want. If they ever, they're actually companies that have products that are in place to make sure they fit with these ESOP rules. And they still get to run the company. Now they have, they're saddled now with an ESOP trust and the valuation requirements associated with the ESOP trust, but they have really taken money off the table and avoided taxes. In an S corporation, you don't get this tax-free rollover treatment. And if the S corporation is less than 100% owned by the ESOP, then the company, they'll still benefit. Because what happens is when stock is being traded in the acquisition using the ESOP interest, those payments get deducted from taxes. So the structure of the transaction, of the initial transaction I talked about, is the owner is selling to the ESOP for dollars, stock for dollars. The ESOP is a shell, doesn't have anything. It's getting a loan from the corporation. So the ESOP turns to the corporation, and let's say it's a $10 million, and it's 100% sale. So the ESOP is saying to the corporation, we'll pay you $10 million. The corporation says, okay, we'll loan you the $10 million. The bank then comes in and gives the corporation the $10 million to loan to the ESOP. So the bank funds, and you say, well, why would the bank do it? There's some really neat advantages for banks to do ESOP deals. Plus, it's being guaranteed by the owner. And the owner, who's getting the money, by the way, as it rolls through, is likely going to pledge or could pledge the margin account. So if it's a five-year acquisition and it's $10 million, bank gives the corporation $10 million. Corporation gives the ESOP $10 million. ESOP gives the owner $10 million. Owner puts the $10 million into preferred stock for tax deferral or not, whatever. And then pledges the remainder back to the bank while the acquisition debt is being funded. 5 years go by. The loan is gone, owner gets their account back without any encumbrances, and voila, everything is done. Now, why do ESOPs get deductible repayments? I don't know. Congress decided they wanted to be able to do that. So if principal and interest on this $10 million loan, let's say it's, a, or whatever the loan is, $500,000 a month, or $100,000 a month, say. So it's $100,000 a month. And if it were a business that was paying that, they would only be able to deduct the interest. So let's say it's $5,000 in interest. So on their tax returns, the $95,000, they're paying taxes on that because they're repaying debt with after-tax dollars, not taking a deduction. In this setting, they're actually getting a deduction. So it's being treated like the whole thing is an interest expense, which is a wonderful piece. It makes it go by a lot faster. The acquisition goes by a lot faster. You could do the same thing as you did initially, what I just described, when it comes to an acquisition, a company using the ESOP. So it's really just doing the same thing. The acquiring company's ESOP borrows money from a bank or some other lender and repurchases all of those newly issued common stock to the target company shareholders for cash and or participation. ESOPs are great tools. So why don't people do them quite as frequently? there's an administrative burden associated with it. There's valuation requirements. And when employees leave, they have to be bought out within a certain period prescribed by the plan. And so you have to maintain certain liquidity. It's a $50,000-ish type of cost at most for an MSP, I would guess. Probably $10,000 to $50,000, depending on your locale. But it's annually. Now you say, wow, that sounds really expensive. Yeah, but you're not paying any taxes either. So that's the nice part about it. I started talking about SCORE in our session. So SCORE is really the issue. I think I may be finished. You're issuing interest in your company for, depending on your jurisdiction, between $1 and $2 million. It's an intrastate transaction. So all of the investors are in the same state. Almost all states have it, I believe. It's normally regulated by the Commerce Department or Secretary of State or something like that. It is a registration, so it's automatic. You don't have to go get approval like you do with the SEC. You register it, you drop it off. 20 days pass, and it's approved, unless they say you're not approved. Now, why wouldn't they say you're approved? There's some bad boy issues if you have like felonies and things like that. Certain people are prohibited from it. So if you're involved in that, if it's a development stage company, meaning it doesn't have a sound business plan in place, it's speculative in nature, they can deny it. Most states, the shares have to sell for a dollar. There's no limitation on the number of investors. It's just on the amount. It's $1 or $2 million, depending on your jurisdiction. And it's once every 12 months. Crowdfunding is another thing that got passed with the Jobs Act in 2012, but took 4 years for them to implement the guidelines for it, so it hasn't really been used since 2016. You can raise $1 million in any 12-month period. It is based on reviewed financials instead of audited financials. You can have non-accredited investors. You can have retail investors through a portal. Like, it's kind of like Kickstarter, but it's not Kickstarter. Kickstarter deals with donations, no expectation of a return. These other crowdfunding portals, I believe the day the regulations came out, there were like 17 crowdfunding portals were approved in 2016. So those portals are doing the offer. You can use the internet to raise funds with crowdfunding. You have to make certain disclosures to the SEC about what you're doing. And then if the investor's income or net worth less than $100,000, they can invest the greater of $2,000, their income, or 5% of income or net worth. Those are the rules associated with it. If income is over, it can be the lesser of 10% of income or 10% of their net worth. So there are some caps on what they can do, and it's up to you or the third-party portal to, depending on who assumes the obligations, to determine whether or not the investor qualifies. So you can't just say, well, the investor said they did, so you actually have to approve it. Now, the states have done intrastate crowdfunding legislation. 30 states have done it. It applies to in-state sales only. To find whether or not you're in-state, normally it's the principal office has to be in the state, plus 80% of its assets and 80% of its gross revenue. In most states, you can do up to $2 million that can be invested by any one or more accredited investors. The non-accredited cap is at $10,000 normally. So a non-accredited investor can invest $10,000. An accredited investor, though, could say, oh, it's a $2 million offering. I'll give you $1.9 million. There's no prohibition on that. Disclosures are made through a platform or portal, very similar to the Jobs Act version of it. And it's $2 million in 12 months if you have audited or reviewed financials. And it's $1 million with no review. There are some bad actor rules, too, on disqualification. Another exit that's kind of creative is this. It's a delayed exit. It involves phantom equity. So what you're doing is you're going to your key employees. Say you got a group of four people, and you say, hey, key employees, I want you to be the next owner of this business. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to create this phantom plan. The base value of our company right now is $5 million, according to SLI or whatever. Formula. Here's the formula. We're going to continue using this formula to value it. So I'm going to give you 50% of the growth of the company over $5 million, because I already own the $5 million. You're going to participate in the growth here, not in the core. So these four employees each divvy up their 50% interest. And now they have a real incentive to grow the heck out of it. And so now over the next several years, the business grows. And so does their phantom interest. Let's say the growth of their interest goes to $10 million. And now you say, let's sell it to you. So the phantom holders say, well, geez, we don't have any money. We've been working our tails off, and we've been working to grow the company, and et cetera. And we're really here because of the phantom equity. But your response is, I'm going to sell it to you guys. That triggers your rights. So now it's worth $10 million. Their 50% interest is worth $2.5 million. You're going to get $2.5 million for the 5 years of growth, plus the $5 million base value. So you're going to get $7.5 million. The phantom holders use their $2.5 million to close. That's their down payment. Now, they are going to not get the full $2.5 million because they got income taxes. And the income taxes are an ordinary income, so it's not insignificant. But if you do it as an asset sale, they actually get a full write-off of the assets that they're purchasing. So let's say it's heavy in equipment, they'll be able to write off a tremendous amount in the year that they're acquiring. So you may have to loan them a little to take care of their taxes, but for the most part, they're funding that transaction totally from the transaction itself. But there might be some seller financing involved to wrap up the sale. But this is a long dance, but it starts out with adopting a phantom plan, and then it goes to growing it, then selling it to the phantom holders. And if you say, well, 2.5% is a lot to give up, here's the deal. In your final year seller, when you're selling, they get a deduction for the $2.5 million. So let's say your operating income for the year that you're selling it for $10 million. And let's say that was your gross revenue and let's just say that your profit that year is $2.5 million. After you do this transaction, you have a $2.5 million deduction now for the bonus that you're paying the phantom holders. So in that final year, while you're taking a reduction in the value, you're also getting a deduction for the amount that they get. So that year, the operating income would be zero. In my example, you had $2.5 million of positive cash flow operating income. Then you did the transaction. The transaction resulted in a bonus being paid of the phantom interest of $2.5 million. It wipes out the profits. You end up walking away with $2.5 million after the expenses. So that's a really neat solution that we have set up several times. We haven't gotten to the execution phases because it's been in the last 5 years, but it's been set up. Another one here is a deferred installment sale trust. I lifted this from a brochure that we did, so that's what the reasoning for the background here being kind of weird. But what happens is the operating company enters into a contract for the sale to a third-party trust in exchange for a note in a security interest. So let's use a Trevor as an example. Trevor sells his company to a trust, which, by the way, he created the trust. And the trustee is a great friend of Trevor's. Let's say the trustee is Will. Will is the trustee. So he's selling it on a contract for deed or contract for sale, installment contract to this trust, also getting back a security interest. Now, the trust doesn't have any money. So the trust says we need 100% financing. So under installment sale rules, Trevor is not getting any gain in the sale of his company. He's selling it for the purchase price and getting 100% finance. The trust is going to pay Trevor interest. So the following year, the trust pays 5% interest on the sale. Let's say it's a $10 million sale. $500,000 goes to Trevor, and none of it gets taxed for the sale of the company. It's just interest only. So that interest only is subject to income taxes, just like Trevor would make on passbook saving account. So after that year, the trust that's operated by Will is now sold for slightly more. So sold instead of 10 million, it's sold for 10 million 500. The 500,000 goes to the benefit of the beneficiary eventually at some point. But Trevor refuses to release the security interest in the asset, the business. So the trust says, we'll give you a security interest in cash instead. So Trevor says, okay, I'll take a security interest in cash. So he takes cash and he's getting an interest payment every year. Say 5 years go by and he's collecting this $500,000. Now the trust has invested this in the stock market or otherwise and is gaining a return on it as well. So in addition to the $500,000 that it made on the sale, it's getting some more. So let's say the beneficiary is Trevor's favorite charity. So at the end of 5 years, Trevor goes to Will and says, hey, Will, trustee of the trust, I'm good with this. I'm living happily on this $500,000. I kind of like the fact that I haven't had to pay taxes on this $10 million sale. I don't want to pay the taxes right now. I'm going to push it out. So here's what we're going to do. Just extend the loan 5 more years. Again, this is a third-party trust. It's not a related party under the IRS rules. So 5 more years, 10 more years go by. Eventually, Trevor could say, you know, make $1 million payment down. Or we could do an on-demand provision that says at any point, Trevor can demand a repayment or partial repayment. So let's say he gets to year 6 and his daughter's getting married and he needs more than 500 grand that year. He says, send me 100 grand. So now the principal goes down and the interest will go down too and whatnot. You get the idea. It defers the recognition of the income taxes. It is a synthetic 1031 exchange when you come to real estate. There aren't any timing requirements though, and there isn't any real estate. So it's really kind of a neat solution. You have to to pay attention to make sure that there's nothing in it that will make it disregarded by the IRS. There's a concept called reciprocal trust doctrine, and a good lawyer will be able to work you through that. It's extremely effective for highly appreciated assets, because when you have these highly appreciated assets and you don't need the value of those assets, you can actually live off the income and not recognize the capital gains. If you combine it with irrevocable life insurance trust, you get tax-free growth and you create some liquidity as well. So the trust could buy life insurance on Trevor, and upon Trevor's death, it can generate a gain from that. The growth inside a permanent life insurance policy is tax-deferred and oftentimes avoided legally, and so there's an opportunity to get that tax-free growth. With the changes that have happened with the SECURE Act, where retirement dollars are kicking out to beneficiaries, and those beneficiaries have to recognize it over the course of 10 years, there are some really good reasons to have an ILET in place, too. It also gives you asset protection. There is an estate freeze component to it, in that you're not growing your estate. You've got a frozen value, a set sum that's being there, and it gives you some great liquidity. It also has this alternative avoiding probate, because the trust sets the terms of how the proceeds will be paid back. You can use it as a substitute for the trust. So thank you for the opportunity to present. My name is Tom Fafitsky. I've been with Virtus Law. We serve MSPs. We do it in a subscription arrangement. We also do a lot of flat fee work in the M&A world. We have probably done, in the last 5 years, 100 mergers and acquisitions. I've been engaged for it or more. Really active in the market, really understand the MSP niche and sector. And if you want to just chat about what we can do for you, normally we're generating a return for our clients on their legal fees. So if you're spending, you know, $20,000 in legal fees on us, it's not uncommon for you to have an income tax savings that is $30,000. So it's a really unique proposition, because it's really more of an investment than an expense. Lots of lawyers are regarded as an expense, and we think we found a way to be regarded as an investment. You can reach me at that number, or you can call my cell phone number, 612-865-1700. I'm at more quarterly sessions of IT Nation Evolve groups, and look forward to meeting you. If you just want to talk, just talk about your business in general while I'm at one of the quarterlies, feel free to reach out to me and we could set up a time to have a cup of coffee and just discuss. Thank you.
Well, that's it for this episode. This is Tom Fafitsky. I'm an attorney with Virtus Law. My team is called the MSP Law Team. We serve MSPs and we'd like to chat with you. Feel free to reach out to us by email. My contact information is Tom, T-O-M, at Virtus Law, D like Victor, I-R-T like Tom, U-S, like United States, L-A-W.com.